came across the so-called unpublished autobiography, which is actually on a Cary Grant fan site. I think it's carrygrant.com or something like that. And it's just there, and we don't know exactly how it got there, but there's no question it's genuine. It's something that was written by him on the basis of transcripts of interviews he did with a Hollywood journalist called Joe Himes. But the thing that really set me off was coming across an article that had been published in Vanity Fair that's quite well known, called Cary in the Sky with Diamonds by Cary Beauchamp and Judy Balaban, all about the times that he took LSD in the late 1950s.
Stripy sweaters, camel coats, turtlenecks, and high-waisted trousers. The story of fashion in the cinema couldn't be told without Cary Grant. We'll talk to the director of a new documentary all about the cinema's finest gentlemen today on The Cinema Show. And if you thought Gucci was all about strolling the streets of Italy adorned in high fashion, well, the powerhouse of style is about to take you to an entirely new world.
There are models kissing aliens, terrifying foggy lagoons, sinister UFOs and holograms. A delight to the eye and a feast for the senses.
We'll preview the brand's newest monster movie-inspired campaign. And a little later...
I kind of just took it off the table. I knew, maybe I should say I decided, that there was no way for this film to speak to everything about the experience of being gay or being gay and black.
We'll look ahead to next week's special interview with the Oscar-winning director of Moonlight, Barry Jenkins. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
The star of four Hitchcock films, Lucky Man, Notorious, Suspicious, To Catch a Thief, and North by Northwest, Mr. Cary Grant.
Thank you. The best is yet to come. Hitch.
Cary Grant, a legend of the cinema, a pioneer of men's fashion, and a man of very few words, at least publicly. Cary Grant is a recurring theme in the story of the motion picture, as suave and in his element in a classic screwball comedy as he might be on the run from a crop-dusting plane with sinister intentions in a Hitchcock caper. But understanding the man himself presents a challenge far greater than any devious Hitchcockian plan. Welcome to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. The story of fashion in the cinema wouldn't be complete without at least a chapter dedicated to the great Cary Grant. Indeed, if it weren't for him, men might have been relegated to stiff, boxy suits while the women had all the fun. Cary Grant's ability to switch between traditionally masculine roles into suave sensitivity gave him an almost undetectable touch of femininity, just enough to set him apart from the rest. The new film, Becoming Cary Grant, attempts to unpick the man behind the perfectly groomed star. Now, if you're expecting interviews with talking heads and stories of backstage antics, well, you'd better prepare for a surprise. The story of the real Cary Grant is as elusive as a jewel thief on the French Riviera. We sat down with the film's director, Mark Kiddell.
I realize it's conventional and usual to praise one's fellow workers on these occasions, but why not? Ours is a collaborative medium. We all need each other. That's how we exist.
We came across the so-called unpublished autobiography, which is actually on a Cary Grant fan site. I think it's carrygrant.com or something like that. And it's just there, and we don't know exactly how it got there, but there's no question it's genuine. It's something that was written by him on the basis of transcripts of interviews he did with a Hollywood journalist called Joe Himes. But the thing that really set me off was coming across an article that had been published in Vanity Fair that's quite well known, called Cary in the Sky with Diamonds by Cary Beauchamp and Judy Balaban, all about the times that he took LSD in the late 1950s. Now, I was aware that there was quite a movement from the moment Albert Hoffman discovered LSD in 1949. There was a movement towards using the drug for therapeutic purposes. It was happening here, it was happening in Czechoslovakia, Canada, and notably in California, you'd kind of guess. But this was long before Timothy Leary. He was probably still at high school or something at that point. And it was not being used for fun. It's not really a fun drug anyway, I would say, having taken it. It can be a fun drug, but it's more of a self-discovery kind of drug. So people were using it for all manner of self-discovery. The CIA were also using it because they thought it could be used as a kind of truth serum. Ministry of Defense in this country were using it, giving it to unsuspecting national servicemen and sending them out on the moor with terrible results in some cases. But Cary Grant took it in the late 1950s, therapeutically, with a medic in Beverly Hills, and he took it over 100 times.
How long is it since we've seen each other?
Oh, well, let's see. I spent 6 weeks in Reno, then Bermuda, about 4 months, I guess. Seems like yesterday to me.
Maybe it was yesterday, Hildy. Been seeing me in your dreams?
It was clear from the article that he afterwards said that during these trips, he relived the whole of his life and went back to his childhood and even beyond, you know, in the sense that he even had sort of pre-birth reminiscences, which are fairly common with LSD, apparently. And some forms of psychotherapy kind of go into that as well. And I thought, well, this might be a way of telling the story. And I was worried because I had no idea how I was going to actually visualize these LSD trips. I didn't want to do it in a sort of ham Roger Corman the trip kind of, you know, psychedelia, because anyway, it was the 1950s and people weren't having acid trips that had been influenced by television or movies. They were having very different experiences in each case, probably very different. And it wasn't until I came across this sort of treasure trove of home movies that he'd shot in the late 1930s, so 20 years before he took the acid, and looked at those. The moment I started looking, there was 4 hours worth of material, all of which was very, very interesting, with phenomenal images, and he had a really good eye, and it's very beautiful stuff. And I thought, oh, this is the way to do it. I was amazed to find this and realise that the film was going to work. But that was only the very beginning of an extremely long and very, very difficult task.
Oh, I'm so glad you're pleased, Mr. Townsend.
But I'm afraid just as obvious.
And what the devil is all this about? Why was I brought here?
I really nearly did my head in over a period of about 3 or 4 weeks before the editing started, sort of trying to cut up bits from the autobiography, select bits of stuff from the home movies, begin to think about the way one could tell the story and how one could somehow work this being subjective at one point inside his head to being somewhat objective from the point of view of the contributors who were going to talk about it. Very early on, a producer friend, Peter Kedley, who was one of the writers and producers of Talk to Me Marlon, in fact, we had breakfast in Hollywood. He was there for an award, and we were talking about the film, and I was talking about interviewing David Thompson for the film and interviewing Mark Lancey, our consultant at Queen Mary College, who's writing a biography. And he said, oh, Mark, you must not have them on screen as talking heads, not if you're going to have a voiceover from Cary Grant. You would completely destroy it. It's much too conventional. And I immediately bought that. The producers didn't. They said, oh, no, you've got to shoot them in vision because you never know, it might not work. But I knew at that point. Mm. I was also inspired. I mean, with all these films, you're inspired by younger filmmakers who do daring things. I was inspired by the way that Asif Kapadia had done Amy with nobody in vision, and it works perfectly well. In fact, talking heads now, I will avoid them at all costs if I possibly can, because they're an enormous distraction. We see our contributors, but the only people we see, the film takes a turn at the end when we kind of leave the whole LSD thing, and we get into the present, and we talk to his fifth wife and to his daughter Jennifer, and they're sort of the product of, if you like, of the success of the LSD treatment. And so it seemed legitimate at that point to be with them in the flesh, in his old house, and Jennifer is sort of 200 yards away, and I think it works very well, that. It was always supposed to be becoming Cary Grant. It was always about the identity thing of being Archie Leach and then becoming Cary Grant. But the more I looked into it, the more I became fascinated by something deeper than that, because that's kind of a story you can tell about so many Hollywood actors who reconstruct themselves, you know, discover that Kirk Douglas was actually Jewish, or Erich von Stroheim, who I'm possibly about to do a film about, was also a Viennese Jew, kind of working class background. And these are all people who somehow were transformed by becoming actors and being on the silver screen, which has that effect. You have that possibility of reinventing yourself. Hollywood's all about that. There's so many Brits who reinvented themselves on both sides of the camera. I mean, Hitchcock and Noel Coward are two other examples of working class Brits who became kind of classless, or in Noel Coward's case, an aristocrat, rather like the Cary Grant. I mean, obviously, one's interested in that, and that's something that's in the film. The film is perfectly watchable for early, someone in their early 20s, like my younger daughter, who knew nothing about Cary Grant, never seen a Cary Grant film, but really enjoyed the documentary, and will, as a result of that, probably go out of her way to watch North by Northwest or one of the screwball comedies. I was much more interested in the psychological damage that occurred to him when his mother disappeared at the age of 11. He thought she'd died, and his life kind of fell apart at that point, and he bunked off from school. He hung around in the harbour here in Bristol. He had a master at school who worked as a part-time electrician at the Hippodrome, at the theatre, and Cary Grant was invited to go and help him and fell in love with acting. That's very important in relation to changing his identity. But he didn't just want to change his identity, he wanted to change the whole place that he lived in. He wanted to move to another country, which is what motivates a lot of immigration, is when you want to reinvent yourself. But apart from the reinvention, there's getting away from this terrible thing of his mother, in his own eyes, having died, but also abandoned him, because she'd been a control-freak kind of mother who'd lost a previous child as a baby, catching his thumb in a door, and then the child had gangrene, and you know, in those days it wasn't that easy to deal with this. So the mother was dressed him in girl's clothes for quite a long time, and was kind of an over-attentive kind of mum. And then suddenly, from one day to the next, he comes back from school, and he's told she's gone away because she's feeling poorly. She's gone to Weston-super-Mare. He has this feeling, clearly, and he talks about it, this is something that must have come out during the therapy, that women are not there all the time. You can have a woman who loves you, and then suddenly from one day to the next, she's gone. The third wife, Betsy Drake, who was the one who introduced him to LSD, I think the relationship worked pretty well, and she became a psychotherapist later on in life, and that she was very well read. She'd been doing yoga in the early 1950s. She was very much sort of Hollywood liberal progressive, more of an intellectual. She'd done some ballet before she went on the stage and stuff. And I think it's worth saying that for me, as I went in, pretty well all the documentaries I do, curiously, I don't know how this happens, but they have some sort of personal resonance. The remarkable thing is that I lost my mother in a similar way, but not the same way, when I was 11. One day, my mother suddenly said, "I've fallen in love with somebody else, I'm leaving you all." This is a terrible shock, just like it was for Cary Grant. And the consequences in terms of my relationships with women, a lot of men react very, very viscerally to the film, very emotionally. When we first showed it here in Bristol for the private screening, several men came up to me afterwards, and one particular one, who's a journalist, said, I'm sorry, I have to admit this, but I was crying in the film, as if it was some sort of sin, you know, for a man to cry in a movie. I mean, I can cry in movies. So the film has a transformative potential that has really very little to do with Hollywood, very little to do with self-invention. It ends up being a story about men and love, and mothers and sons. And that's why I'm very pleased with that, because it takes it out of the world of cinema into something that anybody could enjoy in any culture. I mean, it's a film that can be seen, and I'm very glad it's going to the Beirut International Film Festival in October, because it'll be interesting to see how people in the Arab world react to the film, and I'm sure they'll react in the same way, because this is a universal thing.
Am I to understand you're the man who knows everyone who owns the best jewellery in this vicinity?
We insure most of the important pieces.
Insurance? That's gambling, isn't it?
Shall we say betting?
Yes, let's just say betting.
Mark Cadell there, director of Becoming Cary Grant. That report was produced by Tara Judah. Still to come, we'll take a look at Gucci's new campaign filled with science fiction monsters. And we'll look ahead to our special program next week featuring Barry Jenkins, nearly 6 months after his sensational Oscar victory. But first, if your closet is looking a little lackluster, well, here are three fashion films worth their weight in diamonds. Starting us off at number three, well, it has to be a Cary Grant film. 1955's To Catch a Thief sees him dashing all over Monte Carlo with the sublime Grace Kelly, shortly before she became Monaco's new princess. It was, of course, during her trip to that year's Cannes Film Festival that she first met Prince Ranier. Alfred Hitchcock's classic film features costumes by the most renowned designer of them all, Edith Head. Grace Kelly walks right into fashion history in a pale yellow swimsuit and large white sunglasses. Then there's that cerulean blue chiffon gown, and towards the end of the film, at a ball held on the Côte d'Azur, Grace is a picture of glamour in gold mesh with a matching mask. Watching To Catch a Thief, it's easy to see why Grace Kelly would become a symbol of fashionable elegance. 15 years later, during a visit to a Gucci store in Milan, it was decided that not a single scarf on display was worthy of Monaco's princess, and so a new one was created, the Gucci Flora. Cary Grant, on the other hand, well, he was a man of simple, dignified taste. As he did for most of his pictures, he wore his own wardrobe. That spotty neckerchief and stripy sweater that's become such a classic image, well, Grant picked them up from a local shop, repeating the combination throughout the film. The dark brown loafers he wears with the ensemble, however, they were handmade by Henry Maxwell right here in London. At number two, we have a film from 1974, Eyes of Laura Mars, featuring Faye Dunaway as a fashion photographer in New York City, famous for her controversial depictions of violence. This mystery thriller reaches almost farcical levels as Dunaway's title character begins to experience psychic visions from the perspective of a serial killer, a superb guilty pleasure. And at number one, the final film by the Italian auteur Luchino Visconti, L'Innocente, with its rich symphony of lush 19th century fashions. That's one of the films playing on Mubi right now. Sample a month of movies for free. Just head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. The story of Gucci's involvement in the world of cinema goes much deeper than supplying outfits to some of the screen's most enduring legends. The fashion house's collaboration with Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation has helped restore classic films, including Rebel Without a Cause and the Luchino Visconti film The Leopard. The brand's latest flirtation with film, however, takes a step out of the cinema and deep into outer space. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco takes a look.
Alessandro Michele has injected a much-needed dose of fun into fashion. Since taking the helm of the Italian fashion powerhouse Gucci in 2015, sales have continued at warp speed. This year alone, the numbers are up by 39%. And with a new, colorful aesthetic, the brand is attracting a new legion of young fans. In the 90s, of course, the brand was all about sex. Who could ever forget those saucy and at times X-rated campaigns? This time, however, the focus is on color, lots of color, and patterns, with a dash of retro future.
Her name is Barbarella, and she makes science fiction something else. Jane Fonda is Barbarella. Barbarella is a...
Gucci's Fall-Winter 2017 campaign is a loving tribute to vintage science fiction. There are models kissing aliens, terrifying foggy lagoons, sinister UFOs and holograms. A delight to the eye and a feast for the senses. Voices from the future tell me it will be a hit in the stores. Supplying much of the inspiration was the classic film Forbidden Planet from 1956, starring Anne Francis and Robbie the Robot. Its production design and special effects have come to embody everything we imagine when we talk about classic retro sci-fi.
Imagine yourself as one of the crew of this faster-than-light spaceship of the future, sharing their curiosity to know the unknown.
Star Trek fans may also recognize some of the visual cues in the intergalactic architecture, and the time machine couldn't have chosen a better date to drop in, with a new Star Trek series due on CBS in late September.
How close will we come to the nearest Klingon outpost if we continue on our present course?
1 parsec, sir. Close enough to smell them.
That is illogical, Ensign. Odors cannot travel through the vacuum of space.
The man behind the fashion film is Glenn Lutchford, a longtime collaborator of Gucci's creative director, and a talent clearly as in tune with popular culture as he is with high fashion. The more recent Gucci ads are very playful, a welcome contrast to the Times' stiff upper lip of the industry's also serious elite. If Gucci's classic era made fans want to go shopping in Italy, the hypnotic scenery of the brand's new campaign will have you saving up for your very own spaceship. And with all those glittering leggings, on-your-face shoes, and incredible overcoats, you will not be short of something to wear. It seems to me, minimalism is out. Aliens Go Disco is in. For Monaco, somewhere in outer space, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Thank you, Fernando. Still to come, we will preview next week's special interview with the Oscar-winning director of Moonlight, Barry Jenkins. But first, a quick look at this week's magazines. Variety reports on how director Kathryn Bigelow made the decision to focus on one of America's most troubling instances of social unrest, Detroit, which focuses on a series of riots that erupted throughout the city in 1967, arrives in cinemas 50 years after the violent confrontation. The film is out now in the United States and will roll out across cinemas in other territories soon. The Hollywood Reporter looks at a box office bonanza at Warner Brothers. The studio's parent company, Time Warner, saw its second quarter earnings beat Wall Street expectations thanks to the enormous popularity of Wonder Woman. And over at Vanity Fair, director Brett Ratner takes us inside his office at the Warner Brothers studio lot, which is housed inside Frank Sinatra's old stomping ground. Once known as Sinatra Enterprises, the quaint mid-century gem is now the home of Ratner's own production company, aptly titled Rat Pack Entertainment. Ever since Barry Jenkins took the Oscar for Best Picture at this year's Academy Awards, critics have been pondering on whether his amazing victory comes with a degree of larger meaning. His winning film, Moonlight, is a sweet, sensitive, yet unsentimental coming-of-age story and is unlike any other Oscar winner. Next week, we will sit down for a special one-on-one with Barry Jenkins, nearly 6 months after that sensational moment on stage next to the shocked producers of La La Land. We'll ask him about what it means to be black in today's politically divisive America, and why now is the perfect time for his next project, an adaptation of James Baldwin's If Beale Street Could Talk. Here's a preview.
I kind of just took it off the table. I knew, I decided that there was no way for this film to speak to everything about the experience of being gay or being gay and black or being black. You know, it just wasn't going to reach the totality of any one of those experiences. When I say that I felt a freedom, it was because Terrell Alvin McCraney's life and the life of this character, Chiron, were so alike mine. So just like my experience of growing up in the same place at the same time with a mom going through the same ordeal with crack cocaine addiction, I could draw from personal experience, you know, the barometer for is this right or is that right? You know, I just knew what was appropriate because I had lived many of those things. And I often feel like, you know, because the piece originated not necessarily on the stage, but from the mind of a playwright, there was some visual work or visual freedom that existed within the piece. I got into filmmaking because of the possibility of how metaphor could be carried through sound and imagery. And in reading this piece, which was so rich with words, with dialogue, I just saw, again, just an amazing opportunity, the freedom to take this one piece of art that was very at home in one form and just really run with it and see how it could be sort of necessarily embellished, but how it could be transmuted into a totally different form, carrying the same energy, you know, the same themes, the same power, to be honest, but in a different medium. I wrote the first draft in 10 days, man. It was just such a fluid experience.
I'll be honest, all the way through the film, I actually kept expecting something terrible to happen. I just always was anticipating this sense that something violent or confronting was going to take place in the film. And I was thinking about that to myself as I left the screening and thought, well, perhaps the reason I kept expecting that was that I've seen a number of films that seem to take place in similar sorts of settings, and maybe I'd been conditioned to expect certain things from those stories. So, I mean, this is a poor, fairly rough American neighborhood. But your story is a remarkably gentle story. It's all about sensitive people with feelings. And I came away thinking a key part of the film's resonance comes from the fact that we're presented with these characters who feel so real. Do you feel as though the success of Moonlight perhaps also says something about the wider public's attitude and understanding of this side of America?
I think so. You know, I think for one, I'll talk about just globally. You know, I traveled quite a bit. I spent a lot of time in London. This film, shout out to Altitude Films, and a lot of time all across Europe, to be honest. One of the best experiences I ever had with this movie was in Berlin, and just the how people were willing to cross the distance, the cultural difference, and see themselves in the character. You know, I love that you point out that the movie does take place in this environment where, you know, again, film is a visual medium. There are visual cues. You see certain things begin or certain things set in certain places, and you expect the narrative to have a certain tone, the narrative to progress in a certain way. But I think what's really happening, and this is something that Terrell and I talked about, was the trauma within, the emotional trauma that these characters are dealing with, the emotional violence that a kid like Chiron is forced to endure over the course of time, and how that informs the outward appearance of the character, the outward projection of a character's character. I think it is a quite a violent film, but the violence exists on a totally different wavelength than the audience is expecting because of what they associate with certain types of imagery. You know, this is a kid who's roiling beneath the surface over the course of the film, and yet there are very few physically violent outbursts, and the central violent outburst actually is perpetrated by our sweet, sweet main character. So, and it wasn't this thing where we were trying to subvert expectations or counter people's expectations. It was just a fidelity to the life that we lived.
We'll have that full interview on next week's show. You don't want to miss it.
But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion.
Today's show was edited and mixed by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.
Calls me up from night till morn. Mr. Thorne wants cornered corn, and that ain't hay. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. From Milwaukee, Mr. Fritz often dines me at the Ritz. Mr. Fritz invented Schlitz, and Schlitz must pay. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. Mr. Harris Plutocrat wants to give my cheek a pat. If the Harris pat means a Paris hat, baby. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true.